We're actually going to start now.
Let's start with the good words on loving kindness, the Metta-sutta. This is what should be done
by one who is seeking goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings they may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any evil mistake. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure heart and love, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
I've said before, for those who have a receptive heart, listening to Dhamma will help calm the mind, make it still, like a quiet lake with no breeze, no waves blowing across it. Because Dhamma has that effect to those on those who are receptive. So still your mind. You don't need to focus exactly on what I'm saying if you don't want to. You can just concentrate on the meditation subject. That's fine. Now, I have a a disclaimer to make, I guess. Not what you would call proficient in the suttas. I'm not really a scholar. And my focus is really on the practical application of Dhamma. So sometimes I may translate some of the Lord Buddha's words in perhaps a non-scholarly way, shall we say. And that's simply to get the meaning across as it pertains to the way that one should practice. I make no claim to be a Buddhist scholar. There are those who are far more proficient, far more knowledgeable than I when it comes to understanding the theory. So I try and talk about things that are from a practical perspective, what something actually means. And if that's an offence to someone, then I apologise. Back in the time of the Buddha, a celestial being came to see him and said that it would, or asked the Buddha, say, it would be good if the Lord Buddha explained what some of the great benefits, what some of the great blessings would be. Because the being thought that those in the heavenly realms and the realms of humans would benefit from understanding what things are great blessings. And the first verse that the Lord Buddha replied with was Asevana Chabarana Pandita Nancha Sevana Pujacha Pujaniana Etang Mangamutama, which essentially means that you should avoid the company of ignorant people, foolish people. You should savour the company of the wise and honour those things which should be honoured. He went on to say a lot more, but I particularly want to focus on just one part of that. And that is association with the wise. In our normal lives, the lives we lead, family life, work, social life, we tend not to meet too many of what would be classified as wise people. Because wisdom here doesn't mean clever. We meet clever people. Many academics are very clever in this, the subjects that they study. Even Buddhist academics. But they're not necessarily what's being referred to here as wise. Certainly it's a great blessing if you have that capacity to learn and that capacity. Even the Lord Buddha said further in the same stanza, said that this was a great blessing. But that's not what I'm referring to here. You've come to listen to a talk, a Dhamma talk, and to practice some meditation. To that extent, you too are wise people, because you've taken it upon yourselves to listen to the Dhamma and to practice the Dhamma. And so you should associate with each other. It's good that you come together as a group, because together you get some reinforcement of your own practice. Whereas when you go out into the wide world, the normal world, you tend to get people or mix with people who are actually more of a distraction. You get friends who say, well, would you like a drink? And you say, well, I'm actually practicing five precepts as a Buddhist and I don't drink. And some people will say, that's odd. If they're real friends, they'll understand and it won't be a problem. And then some people might say, well, work colleagues, for example, might say, oh, there's a wowser. Not something that's necessarily supportive. And that's the world that you have to live in. So because most of the social contacts that lay people make are with those who are ignorant of Buddhism and ignorant of the truth, it's important that when you get an opportunity to associate with each other, that you take advantage of that by coming together, by practicing together, and having meetings like this. Because it's important to get that lift, to get that boost of energy from associating with like-minded people. Because the world will drain you of the energy. It will be hard. You swim against the tide. Dhamma, the practice of Dhamma, is the practice of swimming against the tide. For lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, the defilements have ruled the way you respond to the outside world. This lifetime is no different, except for the fact that this time you have an opportunity to understand the defilements and to take action against them. But it's not easy. If it were easy, we would all be enlightened. It's difficult. And so when you get an opportunity to gather some strength to fight the defilements, then you should take that opportunity. So socializing with fellow like-minded practitioners is a good thing. That you take time out from your day to come and associate with other like-minded people is a good thing. It's good karma. And puts you on the path to wisdom. But having said that, it's even better if you can associate with someone who's even more knowledgeable than yourself. If you can associate with someone who's enlightened, then, well, of course, if you could associate with the Buddha at the time, that would be fantastic, and that would be the best kind of association. After that, if you can associate with an Arahant, someone who is enlightened, then that's good because they can guide you. They can admonish you when you need admonishing, and they can give you guidance and support when you need guidance and support. And that's in the Dhammapada, that's what the Lord Buddha said wise people do, that they help those less fortunate than themselves. In the absence of any of the Aryas, then associating with good practicing monks is a good thing to do. You can associate not just by coming to meetings like this, but you can associate by giving them dana, by giving them food in the morning. by helping them with their living accommodation. This monastery is currently building a small hut for the monks to practice in. Donating to that is a good thing and helps build connections between you and the Sangha. And that's a good thing. That's a wise practice. It's a wholesome thing to do. And one of the definitions of being wise is that you understand what is unwholesome and you understand the need to combat those unwholesome characters within your own character, but you also understand what is wholesome, what is good, what leads to good outcomes, and you understand what the causes of that, those wholesome characteristics are. This is part of being wise, not part of being clever, part of being wise. Interestingly, most English translations of the word the word panya in the Pali word panya is wisdom. We talk about wisdom, the wisdom of the Buddha. But panya itself, a more literal translation of that, would be correct knowledge or correct understanding. So it's not just wisdom in terms of worldly wisdom, but it's actually what is real knowledge. And of course that gets back down to understanding the world as being suffering, the world as being impermanent, and the world as being not self. Anicca dukkha anatta. In Pali. And when you understand those things, then, or you study those things, then you're on the path to wisdom. Or a better Pali term for that kind of knowledge and understanding is Jnana Dasana. And that means to have vision and insight, and it's vision and insight into the nature, the real nature of reality, the true nature of reality, not this conventional world that we see through the prism of delusion. When we look at the Four Noble Truths and we see the Eightfold Path, the first two steps, well, they're not steps, the first two conditions of that path are right view and right understanding. And it's generally thought of that those two elements of the path constitute the wisdom component of it. So there's Sila Samadhi and Panya, morality or virtue, concentration or calmness, and wisdom, the three elements of the Eightfold Path. And the first two, right view and right understanding, or sometimes right thought, they're the wisdom component. You need to be wise first. You need to understand, at least acknowledge that the Dhamma is worth practicing, that it can lead to freedom from suffering. Once you can acknowledge that, then you can start to practice. That's why you need to have a right view in the first instance. So the wise amongst us start to develop right view and a right understanding. And as I said, one of the qualities of right view is to understand what is unwholesome, and we know that. I've spoken about that before. The defilements, the kilesa, greed, aversion, delusion, lobha, dosa, and moha in Pali. And knowing what is wholesome. And that's the opposite of those things. So generosity is a wholesome characteristic. Loving kindness is a wholesome characteristic. Knowledge, jnana dasana. Right kind of knowledge, the knowledge which leads to insight, the knowledge that leads to understanding the world as it really is. That's a wholesome thing, to pursue that through our meditation. Right view also incorporates the understanding that the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, freedom from suffering, and the Eightfold Path. The view that these four truths are just that. They are true. Not one of them is true and the other three aren't, or that they're only true sometimes. These are universal truths. Whenever there is in existence beings, sentient beings, these four truths will hold fast. Whether it's in this universe, next universe, previous lifetimes, the Four Noble Truths will always be that. They are Arya Satya. They are noble truths. They are beyond conventional truth. To have that as a view is a right view. To understand the nature of the four nutrients is also right view, and it is a view therefore of wise people. This body is fed by nutrient, by food that we eat, the water that we drink, the air that we breathe. And because of those things sustaining this body, we have senses. And sense objects make contact with the senses, and through the senses make contact with the mind. So these sense doors and the contact with these sense doors gives food for thought. Again, a nutrient sustaining the thought process, sensory experience. And that thought process itself is the food of karma. Karmatic thought expressed through thought, bodily actions and speech. And those karmatic forces that are formed fertilize consciousness, which is the rebirth consciousness. So they sustain rebirth. To have this is your view of the world is the right view. And this is the kind of view that you should cultivate if you wish to be wise. If you wish to be free from suffering, then these are the sorts of views that you must cultivate. You must look for in your meditation and see the truth that lies within. And then there's the Very similar to the nutrients, this paticca samuppada, or dependent origination, which is too detailed to go into in this talk, and I have spoken about that before. But basically, it's the law of cause and effect. That one thing begets another, begets another, begets another. A chain reaction which actually goes in a circle. So ignorance causes, ignorance is the main cause driving the wheel of life. And that ignorance is the very opposite of what I was talking about before, which is correct understanding. Ignorance of the Dhamma causes repeated bouts of suffering from life to death, to rebirth, to death, to rebirth. The wheel is unbroken because ignorance drives it. Knowledge and vision, purity of knowledge and vision through the refinement of our understanding of the world that we live in, the world that is our body and mind, the world as we experience it, a real understanding of that refines knowledge, refines our experience of the world, it refines our understanding of the world. And as we refine our understanding and the purity of our knowledge increases, then the level of ignorance decreases. So effectively what we're doing when we practice Dhamma, whether that's through practicing of generosity, through the practice of morality, which form the basis of good Buddhist practice, or whether it's through the practice of meditation, what we're really doing is we're retraining our minds to overcome the bias that they've accumulated over many lifetimes. So, practicing the Dhamma is a re-education program. People think of enlightenment and like a light bulb going on, being switched on. But really, enlightenment is a grinding away at ignorance, the ignorance that we were born with. Grinding away, sharpening our wisdom, sharpening our insight till it can penetrate the fog, which is ignorance, which is driven, which is the driver of birth, old age, sickness and death. So it's not something that occurs instantly, even though enlightenment might take place just in a single moment. The fact is that's the culmination of lifetimes of work, lifetimes of refining, lifetimes of grinding away at ignorance, until such time as ignorance is ground back to zero. And that's the moment that you become enlightened. But it's certainly not just a light bulb moment where you can suddenly flick a switch. It takes a lot of practice. So when we practice, we shouldn't be despondent. We shouldn't think, oh, my practice not going well. Oh, I'm not doing too well today. I was better yesterday. We just put in the causes, that's all we need to do. Grind away. Don't look for the result. Simply make sure that you apply the cause. Because if you practice, if you develop your mindfulness and start to be aware of the fact that your mind does drift, then at least that's a little win. But if we start to think, oh, this is just all too much, things aren't going well, then you're giving in to your defilements. And what you really need to do is not wish for an outcome, only be skillful enough to put together the right causes. So be skillful enough to start to develop mindfulness. Be skillful enough to keep with your meditation subject. Be skillful enough to start to analyze what it is that you're meditating on. What does the breath do when it comes in and goes out? What does it signify? What is it telling me? It's telling you it's impermanent for a start. It's telling you that if it stops, then you die, and that's some suffering as well. And where is the me? Where is the I in the in-breath coming in? Because when it goes out again, do I go out with it? Whatever your meditation subject is, there's always some trick of the trade that you can start to apply. And if you don't search for tricks of the trade, if you don't search for little gems, little clever means of flicking your meditation subject around so you can see it from a different aspect, then that's you just being lazy. You have to apply right effort. And that means that you don't try and concentrate on what you think the results of your meditation should be. Like I said, you concentrate on putting the causes together. And if you become skillful at putting the causes together, mindfulness, concentration, insight, they'll all follow, just as surely as night follows day. So that's your responsibility now, to develop your own knowledge, your own wisdom, to associate with other people who are practicing in the same way, who are going to support you in your effort, who you can confide in, who you can go and explain when things are not going well, or that you can share your experiences with if you want to. Whether that be a calming experience, happiness, stillness, or whether they be some kind of insight or some kind of vision. Because these people will support you. So if you want to practice Dhamma, if you want to be one of those wise people, if you want to be free from suffering, then you must cultivate wisdom, insight, in the manner that I've just explained. And then anything is possible. You too can become enlightened, but you need to put in the practice. And the practice has to be the right practice with correct knowledge. And that's all for me. Amen. So, we'll do some meditation now. So, we've all been here several times before. We all know how to practice. So I'm not going to do a guided meditation session. Just take whatever meditation subject you found to be useful and focus your attention on that, either through observing it, staring at it in your mind's eye, or by examining it from the point of view of being impermanent or suffering or an aspect of suffering or devoid of self. Any of those approaches is a viable and correct way to address your meditation subject. one of the things that we're doing when we meditate is to try and develop our mindfulness. So we just want to be mindful of the subject, and that allows us to become concentrated. And if the mind drifts and mindfulness catches it, then mindfulness should bring the mind back to its meditation subject. Mindfulness should be the tether that links the meditator with his subject. And the more that we practice, the sharper our mindfulness should get. And then that allows us to become concentrated, which in turn gives us the strength of mind to be able to develop insight. But we need to put in the effort and not become despondent. Simply let go of everything else but your meditation subject. And relax. And focus your attention on whatever your chosen subject is. gradually start to just come back to a normal state. Just take your time, no hurry. Just enjoy the calm, the stillness. Has anybody got any questions? Not that I'm anticipating that you will. I'm glad I explained things so clearly that no one has any questions.
If anything, very clear tonight.
How was it?
Yeah, it was very go around and start building the vineyard. That's cool.
Good. I'm glad someone got some benefit from it. Over to Bill.
Now I understand the verses of sharing and aspiration.
May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, and the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, and those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind and desire of the in every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all things, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Thank you. Until next time.
Thank you very much.
You're all welcome.